to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. A weekly podcast where the discussion is about the most recent horror and genre films. Intelligent talk on a genre that deserves intelligence. A conversation between co-hosts discussing not only the film, but also the connotation that the directors and screenwriters are trying to articulate. When you want more than a review, listen to Dark Discussions.
And speaking of perception, there's just one more scene I want to talk about, which is after Caleb discovers that Kyoto's a robot, Kyoto kind of peels off her skin, showing him what's underneath.
Now, wait a minute. I know where you're going with this, but tell me you weren't already thinking this 15 minutes earlier in the film. Exactly what he's thinking at that moment.
Which is he's a robot, too.
Oh, I considered the possibility.
Right, and that's what I like, is the fact that the writers were smart enough to know that this is what the audience would be thinking.
We've all seen Blade Runner.
Right. Exactly.
www.darkdiscussions.com, wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Phil, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I am well. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing all right. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am pretty awesome. I'm glad things are calming down in my world because it was really insane there for a while.
Very well. We do have another co-host from Massachusetts, Abe, who unfortunately can't make it tonight.
So screw that guy.
Screw that guy. Technically, this is our real, quote-unquote, first episode of 2020. There's been a couple recordings, but those usually are mostly fall back to the 2019
and
stuff.
People will know that since we said the date.
Exactly. And the date is that we're recording this is January 9th, 2020. That's what we're at, 8:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For new listeners, what Dark Discussions is. Dark Discussions is a podcast that discusses and critiques genre films. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, cult films, and the like. We try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We do have a website, darkdiscussions.com. What can people find there, Eric?
Oh, they can find a bunch of stuff. On the right-hand side of the page, they can find links to friends of the podcast. Up at the top of the page, you can find links to an article section where there are articles written by myself as well as others. There's also an audio section where you can find every single episode of the podcast that's been recorded as well as any of the spinoffs available to download for free. You're bound to find something that you're interested in there, so check it out. On the front page, front and center, is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon allows you to financially support your online artists like podcasters. You can go, and for every $5 a month that you care to donate to help us offset the cost of the podcast, which includes things like server fees and replacing broken equipment, you will have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover. We take all the submissions from our patrons and draw them randomly. Hang on, let me try that again. We take all the submissions from our patrons and on a quarterly basis draw them randomly to pick a topic chosen by one of our patrons to do an episode on. For more details, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussion or go to darkdiscussions.com and follow the link on the front center. And I believe we're drawing one of those tonight. Is that right, Phil?
That's right. That's right. Before we get into that, just two other things. The Facebook group is Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where we have approximately 800 participants that discuss genre and horror things. So the possible Jaws remake, the possible Howling remake, that's being discussed now over there, among other things. And also you can email darkdiscussions@aol.com and we will read your email on the podcast. Whatever you have, such as films that you think would interest folks, your review of a film, or anything else, ideas, questions, and such. So darkdiscussions@AOL.com. So yes, Eric, we do have tonight, since it's the beginning of the quarter, we get to pick a new patron, and I believe Mike has a number generator that will randomly pick from that list we have.
I think I do, yes.
All right, what do you got?
No dramatics, no drum roll, just there we go. And the number is 147.
147. All right, it's a film called Dig Two Graves. Never heard of it.
T-W-O Graves.
Dig Two Graves. Let me see if I can find this. All right, it does exist. 2017 film stars Ted Levine. 76% good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes.
Is she a great big fat person?
That's right. Exactly. That's terrible. Haunting and darkly beautiful tale of revenge. Ted Levine and Samantha Isler. Interesting. All right. So we will directed by Hunter Adams, written by Hunter Adams and Jeremy Phillips.
So,
from an old saying that, you know, when you seek revenge, you should dig two graves.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to see this, and for some reason it felt, that was the year I got sick. That's why the second I saw the poster, I went, wait a minute. This was one of those ones I wanted to see. So cool. I forgot about it, but yeah, it just looks good.
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting. So, Dig Two Graves. And so we're hoping to probably get that in sometime in the month of February, I think, once we wrap up our year in review lists and all that stuff.
Well, I got to tell you, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of horror stuff coming out like in the winter this year.
Yes.
Isn't there? Yeah. There's a bunch. So.
Yep. So, look out for that. We will be doing that episode soon enough. All right. So that's pretty much that. Once again, thank you to the Patreon participants. At the moment, we have five folk who donated.
I'm sorry, Phil. Did you say whose pick that was?
Unfortunately, I don't know. This one was prior to where I put the names of the people.
Okay.
It was.
Well, if you're out there and that's your pick, send us an email and let us know.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I think to be honest, it may be Gage Fultz or Michelle Barkley or someone because it's near.
They'd be good picks. They'd be likely.
Yeah.
As long as it's not.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Oh, I don't know if I should bleep that out. But either way, sounds good. So. We will do that one. All right. So tonight we do have a special episode, not a review of a film like we usually do. And it came up, this idea, because of you, Mike. So why don't you explain what this is all about?
Yeah. Explain what you've done.
Yeah, because Eric hates a tradition. This is the third year or fourth year we're doing this now?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember.
I think it's our third.
Maybe.
Where I suggested was looking for a theme, because we're not doing anything else in the month of January that we schedule every year. Yeah, we all make, not all of us, but many of us make New Year's resolutions, and really many of you should, because you're all letting me down. one of the things that we always have films that we've always wanted to see but haven't, and so why not make a New Year's resolution to watch one of those films that's on our bucket list. Because really what we do here so much for the podcast eats up a lot of my time. And I feel a lot of pressure to watch new stuff in theaters, and I don't get a chance to go back and watch older catalog films. And you know, I think because we were just talking about this, offline before, Eric, you said you'd seen how many films this year?
Total of 52.
52,
or...
yeah.
Yeah, and I'm at probably around 70. And I don't know, there's people that have watched hundreds of films, and I don't know how you do that if you don't, you know, unless you have no job. But, Yeah, so that doesn't leave a lot of time to go back and watch his older films. So we all pick a film that is on our bucket list, a film that we've never seen before. We do not tell anybody, well, at least nobody on the podcast, what it is that we're watching. And then we do a quick roundtable here to say what we saw and what we thought of it.
Yep, that's right. That's right. So as Mike said, we each have watched the film, yet we don't know what the other has watched. So I have no idea what Mike or Eric or Chrissy's watched. Abe did it as well, though he couldn't join us, but he did send us a few few paragraphs of his opinion of the film.
I don't think we should read it. He didn't show up.
Yeah, well, maybe usually we do alphabetical order, and he would have gone first by first name. But since he didn't show up, well, I guess we'll just read his at the end of the episode.
let's get it out of the way. Let's do it first.
All right, that's fine. So let's start with Abe's, and Chrissy was kind enough to willing to read it, I guess. So
yes,
Chrissy,
absolutely. Okay. Hey, everyone, this is Abe, or rather a message, as I couldn't make it to this recording. For this bucket list episode, I actually had a hard time deciding on a movie and went through list after list of movies. Eventually, I chose the 1978 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. One of the first things I noticed, along with my brother, was how good the effects looked, along with its cinematography. The movie does a great job of slowly revealing that something was really wrong, such as the terrified man running across the street, the horrible sounds, or the people creepily watching Elizabeth's every move. The concept of being taken over the moment you tried to sleep, and that the people you know are no longer who they appear to be, this is why this and John Carpenter's The Thing are so disturbingly effective. The major cast played their roles very well, though some of the extras sprinkled a bit of cheese every now and then. It was cool seeing Sutherland, Goldblum, and Nimoy in this movie together. Though I knew of the movie's famous twist ending, it did not take away my overall enjoyment. It is a flick worthy of its cult status. That's it.
All right, very well. Phil Kaufman was the director. Screenplay by W.D. Richter, and the incredible cast of Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, Leonard Nimoy, Jeff Goldblum, Veronica Cartwright, and even a cameo from Don Siegel and Philip Kaufman and Kevin McCarthy, who all were participants. Well, at least Don Siegel and Kevin McCarthy were the participants of the original version. And Philip Kaufman, of course, had a cameo in this one, and he directed this one. Art Hindle, too, the Canadian actor. He's pretty good, too. So, it's a pretty solid film. I know, Mike, you love it a lot, and me and you discussed at least three times as this to be a potential episode for the podcast, and every time we've never been able to do it for some reason.
Yeah, I love the film. I remember seeing it in theaters. I would have been 8 or 9 years old because depending on when exactly it came out that year. I don't remember liking it a lot at the time because I was young. I loved the original, but I think it was a little slower and a little bit more mature in a lot of ways. And so it was a little bit above my head, and I kind of rediscovered it later. But I always remember the final image, which is great. If you've never watched Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the final image with of Donald Sutherland is kind of iconic and classic. And then I think I rediscovered it when I was in college. And, I have a very, very big spot in my heart for the original. And this one I hold kind of right along with it. Other than the fact that the original one in the 50s is a bit dated in its themes, it's still very well crafted for its time. I don't know which one I really like better. So it's a good example why I don't just immediately dismiss remakes out of hand.
Yeah, for me, I actually think I saw it on like HBO or something as a kid. And yeah, I loved the film as a little kid and always remembered it. I do like the little cameo at the beginning as Patient Zero, being my favorite actor at the time and probably still today, which was Robert Duvall, has a minor cameo. Yeah, the special effects are incredible. The paranoia is great. I always looked at it similar to, as Abe mentioned, John Carpenter's The Thing, because it kind of had that same paranoia. And it came out same time, as well as like The Shining was another one that had that paranoia feel. And so a lot of films, horror films at that time had that feel. And I also, I saw the original, I just saw it within the past year because I bought, the Blu-ray of it. I had never seen it. One of the few 1950s that I only like saw like 5 or 6 minutes back when I was a kid, when it was on TV, but never watched it. Even though that's a good film, I really do think this is the one I prefer, similar to the John Carpenter, The Thing. I even though I love the original, both these remakes, I think, are better, at least for me. And I do agree with you, Mike, that this is a reason why remakes should not just be poo-pooed, because sometimes they are pretty damn good. What about you, Eric? Have you ever seen this film?
Yeah, it's a good movie. There are wow, how many versions of this story are there at this point? A lot.
Officially four.
Are you counting The Faculty? Because it's pretty darn close.
No, that's why I said officially there's four.
Okay.
Then you throw in The Faculty, you throw in The Puppet Masters, which is the adaptation of Heinlein's science fiction story, which I think predates this. But it's a similar theme. And then you get, I know like there was an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer that was similar to this. Because there's all sorts of things.
And well, you know, what's funny is that Jack Finney, the author of the novel, he actually said that his influence to write this novel, was John W. Campbell's Who Goes There, which is basically John Carpenter's The Thing.
They're all related, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, no, but the 78 version is, it's got its own thing, and I think it's probably one of the stronger renditions of the story. I haven't watched it in quite some time, but yeah, that final image is, that'll stick in your head. It's a good flick. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out.
Eric, do you have the Scream Factory? Because that came out. They made the special edition Scream Factory.
I do not.
Okay. I was just wondering. You do, Mike, right?
I do. I haven't watched the special features yet, but I do have it.
Yeah, same here. I haven't watched the special features yet, but I do as well. Chrissy, what about you? Have you ever seen this film? I know at one point you actually considered this a couple of years ago as possibly the film that you were going to talk about on one of these type of episodes.
Yes. I did actually watch it at that point because my housemate Charles has the really nice, like whatever the super edition is. I don't know if Criterion did one or whatever, but he's got like this giant set with all this extra stuff. And I did watch it. It was only a few years ago, it seems like. And, you know, it disappointed me a little bit. I think because my parents really loved this film, I remember them going out on a date night actually to see it and talking about it. And oh my gosh, they loved this movie. And I think I had built it up in my mind to be something. I guess it probably didn't live up to my expectations. That doesn't mean it wasn't good. I think there are some chilling moments in it. I do think I would call it a slow burn because it develops a little bit slowly, but the acting is wonderful. Not in a bad way. I don't mean slow like boring slow. I mean slow burn. There is a lot of story that's built, and it's built very well. I definitely think the special effects, most of them, do hold up. I think my favorite scene in this is probably that scene is it the back of the laundromat or the spa or something where the people are laying down on the stretchers or whatever in the showers? Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That is hands down my favorite scene in this. I just got chills watching that. In fact, I was more disturbed by that brief scene than I was by the iconic thing at the end. But yeah, I mean, I like this film. I recommend it. And what also makes it interesting is that it's also a time capsule of, well, late 70s, you know, genre. This is what it was. It was, it's very different in speed. It's very different in tone from what we know today.
All right. Very well. Very well. So 1978's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, pretty much we can be found anywhere. And as we've discussed, it has a special edition by Scream Factory that is loaded with stuff. So, yeah, it's a big thumbs up, at least in most people's opinion and so forth. So, all right. So I guess we can get into your topic, Eric, since this is alphabetical order by first name.
All right. Well, I went way back and watched what some consider to be the first horror movie ever, released in 1920, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Cool.
Oh, my God. Nice. I'm so excited. Go ahead. Go ahead.
It's a silent movie, and it's black and white, and it's really old, so expect those things if you go to check it out. When I was trying to figure out how to get a hold of it, I found it was streaming on Amazon Prime, so I did my little, I got an Apple TV with the little Siri remote or whatever, and I just did a Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and it brought up something, and I just clicked on it without really looking at it closely, and I like the little bar came up with the runtime, and it was like 2.5 hours. I'm like, what the fuck? So it turns out that
this
thing they have on Amazon is actually, it's like some Halloween combo they have that actually starts with Nosferatu and then has the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So if you haven't seen Nosferatu, that's also worth checking out. They're both together in that thing on Amazon, so just be prepared for that if you go looking for it. It is, you know, it's the kind of movie that again demonstrates why I generally don't care for older movies. Plot's not very complex. The wiki on IMDb reads, hypnotist Dr. Caligari uses a somnambulist, Caesar, to commit murders. Yeah, well, that's it. there's a whole bunch of stuff that's written on this movie. If you look it up on Wikipedia, it is a apparently a German impressionist film, and really gave notice to the world that German filmmakers should be taken seriously. So it's got that going for it. A lot of the sets in the movie look kind of cartoonish. Like the house that Dr. Caligari lives in, and it's literally drawn onto a piece of cardboard, and it's crooked and distorted and everything. So it's got this kind of surreal feel to it. And also, I sent Mr. Watson a message after I watched this movie because he is not a fan of the whole they were crazy the whole time ending. And this might be also the first example of that 100 years ago, where they tell this whole story about Dr. Caligari and how he's murdering people with his somnambulist. And it turns out it's all just the delusions of someone in a mental asylum at the end of the movie. Spoiler alert for a 100-year-old movie. so, I mean, if you want to, you know, check it off your list so you can say you've seen it, I would say go check it out. It didn't thrill me. I'm glad I've seen it so I can say I've seen it. And for people who are into film history, I imagine it's something you have to see because it's certainly got a lot of that. And its importance in that manner is, in my opinion, a lot more than any significance as a great horror movie, because it's certainly by today's standards a little bit tame and not very scary, and also a little confusing because when the splash card popped up about somnambulist, I looked at that word and I was like, are they talking about a sleepwalker? I looked it up and I was like, yeah, they're talking about a sleepwalker, but I think the word must have had a slightly different implication 100 years ago. Because like this dude in the story like sleeps in a box and he's always asleep. And then Dr. Caligari has this like road show where he wakes him up and has him tell people's future. And he usually says, "You're going to die tonight." And then makes that come true by going and murdering them later. And the meaning behind the title is that this box that the somnambulist is in is Dr. Caligari's cabinet, and he has a dummy that's an exact replica of Caesar. So the cops sit there and watch Caesar sleeping all day, and it's actually a dummy, while Caesar is out and about committing murder. But the cops think he couldn't have possibly done it because they were looking at a dummy of him and thought it was him the whole time. So, yeah, not particularly thrilling or scary, but it is a piece of history, and I'm glad that I watched it. Has anybody else seen this?
No, but I am interested. So is this whole thing of using somebody hypnotized to murder people, does it seem feasible to you? Because I've got ideas.
I don't know. You'd have to get somebody to be pretty far under your spell.
No, this is definitely one I hadn't, weirdly enough, I hadn't even thought about going back that far. But if I had, that certainly would have been one of the ones on my list, because there's that. And Der Golem, also German, that had been on my list. I mean, I remember reading books about horror films when I was in elementary school, and they were mentioning this film. Of course, at that point, the film was only 60 years old, so it was much fresher. but yeah, wow, okay. Yeah, so that's, yeah, it's definitely one on my, also on my bucket list, and I'd like to check out at some point. It's definitely, you know, a legendary film. Your fandom should never necessarily be homework, but if you want to be an informed fan, it sounds like, everyone says this is like one of the more important films, if not one of the best films, it's one of the more important films. So if you want to know your history of the genre, you want to be an informed genre fan, you probably should at some point, sort of like you should at least once watch, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein, Nosferatu,
right,
Godzilla,
Metropolis.
Metropolis. Yeah, Texas Chainsaw.
I haven't caught Metropolis yet. Maybe next year.
Yeah,
One thing I will mention that was kind of making me snicker while I was watching this movie is that they will often have scenes where there will be a couple people talking for a couple of minutes. It's a silent movie, so you see them on the screen and you see their mouths moving for like 2 minutes, and then a splash card will come up saying something very succinct like, "He went that way." It's like, ah, come on, I know he said more than that. What are you doing? Tell me the truth. What did he say?
Yeah, I've seen that as a joke in like a in some comedy where they're using subtitles for somebody speaking in a foreign language.
Was it Mel Brooks' silent movie?
It could have been, but it's where somebody says something clearly very long, you just get a little thing. And then somebody else says something like one word and a whole paragraph pops up.
Right. That was also a bit they did in Wayne's World with subtitles on.
It could have been that. It's also, you know, and when you think about it, I guess an easy joke to make. So it's probably been done multiple times.
But I don't think this was a joke. I think this
I
was.
I doubt
it. Yeah. Right. They had a script they were using on the set. And they were looking at it, and they were like, "That's way too many fucking words. Just write this."
Yeah, it's like the Hong Kong karate films, right? They went to dub it. It's right, like three words, and the guy's speaking for like 20 minutes.
You know, and the thing is, this is a movie that's so old that they could have a character in it. I don't know if they do, but they could have had a character in it named Adolf, and nobody would have thought twice.
Right.
Right. Well, there's still a lot of Adolfs in Germany, I think, in Austria and Switzerland. So
it's just everybody else in the world sees a German character named Adolf, and we all know where their mind goes.
That's the truth.
That's the truth.
Yes. I haven't seen this one either, Eric. But I've always seen you know little clips and all that, and obviously it's impressionistic, and obviously very low budget. If they're just cardboard and all that stuff. But I think it's remembered so much is because of the impressionism, the German impressionism, and it was like the beginning of it, and
yeah,
and the symbolism versus the reality. And it is looks pretty cool. I mean, when you look at it, when I was a little kid, you know, looking at these weird pictures of or clips from it, it kind of looks scary. But I'm sure that it isn't for a jaded viewer of 2020.
Well, and this came out in 1920. Are there like that's pretty close to the beginning? Like, do you know when the first movie was released?
Yeah, I think it was that Moon, the French flick that Moon, and that was like what, 1907 or something.
Well,
like that
wasn't. Well, I mean the. Yeah, it's turn of the century, the first films, and I know
what
they
was
were
that?
Doing
To Shoot to the Moon or something.
Yeah. Trip to the Moon, I think. But yeah, it's it was French, so translate however it translates to English. But I mean, it's hard to say because they were doing like little short film stuff in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people look at like Birth of a Nation as the first modern film.
Okay.
And that was screened in Woodrow Wilson's White House, so that's the 19-teens.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because that's
so
the
this
first
is, this
one.
Is way
that
back.
Was like
this
an
is pretty
epic
close
length
to the
of 90 minutes.
Yeah, and like A Trip to the Moon, even though that's like possibly the quote unquote the one of the first, it's still only like a 13-minute film versus
right.
Birth of a Nation, which is a full length feature. Yeah. Yeah, and I know Al Jolson, he had some stuff, you know, like, what, 1919 or something, I don't know. But what about you, Chrissy? Have you ever seen this film or anything?
Yes, I did a very long time ago. It was probably back when I moved in this house, I want to say 1997. This was one of the first things, along with Nosferatu, that Charles, my housemate, kind of introduced me to. And, you know, it's not so much that we're crazy about silent films, either of us, but I really came into his life with very little knowledge of the horror movies roots, very little knowledge. And so he kind of started with Nosferatu, yep, Haxan. You know, all these like old, like way old stuff. And then we just kind of moved forward and it took us like a few years to get through a lot of it. But it's good. I'm very grateful to him because he pretty much gave me my education. I unfortunately have an incredibly terrible memory for movies. So I'm pretty sure that if I watch this now, it would honest to God be just like watching it for the first time all over again. I remember a couple of images, but that's about it. And I know how it ends, but that's about it. I don't remember much.
Spoiler warning, it's a dream.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if that really is one of the first instances of that trope. That would be interesting to find out. Like in a movie. I mean, I know there were other silent movies, too, at that time, so...
There can't be many before it.
No, I mean, it is really...
I mean, literally.
Yeah. I'm just right. Wondering if that was the very first use of that in the horror genre. You know, I mean, it's quite possible that that trope was used in other types, but, you know, comedies or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think comedies were pretty much, right? The silent films, the early ones... Weren't they mostly comedies?
My film is not up to speed, so I don't know.
I think they were romance, right? Because what was that guy that everybody loved that invented the watch? The Italian name.
Dr. Timex?
No. There's a famous actor of that era that was huge, and all the ladies loved him. And then once he suicided because once the talkies came out, his career kind of went down the tubes. Rudolph Valentino.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The watch?
Yeah. Well, the wristwatch.
The wristwatch. Okay. Huh.
Yeah. Because he wanted a watch that he didn't have to keep on pulling out of his pocket, like a pocket watch. And so he invented the wristwatch. Yeah.
Wow. The things you learn on the Dark Discussions podcast.
That's right.
That is like so cool.
Yeah, and his films, those were all silent, and those were all like romantic, epic type stuff. So, you know, like it play, take place in period piece type stuff like Egypt and whatever, you know, so.
So I don't have a whole lot more to say about the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, so I'll turn it over to Chrissy for her pick.
Okay, so Phil does not know what I chose. The movie that I chose to watch was actually the 1975 TV movie The UFO Incident, which actually has an alternate title called The Interrupted Journey, which is not only the same as the title of the 1966 book it's based on, it also is multi-leveled in that both the book and the TV movie, I read the book many years ago, builds an arc around this couple, Betty and Barney Hill, who were a mixed-race couple living in New Hampshire. But despite all the prejudices and difficulties they faced because of that, because it was 1961 when this incident occurred. So we were on the cusp of the civil rights movement. Mixed race coupling was pretty much, you know, unheard of. It just was not done. They were very much in love with each other and very happy until the night of this event, which happened in September. Of that, of
61.
Yeah. They claimed that they were on the way home from a vacation in Montreal and they got lost somewhere on, I think, Route 93 or Route 3 up in New Hampshire. Something like
yeah,
that.
It was Route 3, which is kind of like a two lane, 50 mile an hour.
Yeah,
type
yeah.
Road. Nowhere.
Yeah, and it goes through like Forest
and
stuff.
Littleton, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and they lived in Portsmouth, I believe, New Hampshire. And according to the film,
yeah, pretty close to Portsmouth. Yeah.
Yeah, they were abducted by aliens.
Londonderry. I think it was Derry, maybe. But anyway.
But anyway, the movie stars James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons. The reason that it is considered kind of a cult classic and like a lot of people know about it is because it really is one of the very first movies that kind of established this whole alien abduction subgenre. There were plenty of movies about, you know, aliens and Martians and stuff like that in the 50s and you know, even in the 60s. But when this movie came out in 75, it is my understanding that this was one of the earliest examples, if not the earliest example, of that alien abduction genre with the Greys. I believe the next famous movie that came out was the movie Communion, which was based on the book of the same name by Whitley Strieber.
Oh,
so,
don't get Close Encounters.
Well, yeah, Close Encounters too. Yeah,
that was
absolutely.
78, I think.
That was 78, yeah. But it really kind of founded that. Now, before, Phil, you say I can't count this as a bucket list film. The last time I saw this, saw it from beginning to end and really focused on it because I really haven't seen it in years, was in the fall of 77. So I was 6 years old and I was at my grandmother's house and my grandmother's house was kind of creepy. And so that may have intensified my reaction to this film, but in all honesty, I was so freaking terrified that I must have either blocked all of it out. I don't have much in the way of memory. I remember very little of it. I remember the emotions I felt more than anything. I remember feeling sheer terror. I remember hiding my eyes behind a pillow on the couch, and I remember I could not sleep without the lights on if I slept at all for weeks afterward. So, needless to say, I never actually watched this movie again. I was like, that movie was so fucking scary. I never, ever in my life want to see this again. And if it was on TV, I would just pass it. I'd be like, oh my God, get that away from me. It's so scary. I don't want to see it. So recently, like about 4 years ago, I guess, Phil, whenever that last time was, you and I were talking about it.
Yeah, it was about 4 years ago.
Yeah, I decided that I was going to put it on my list of movies that I would like to see again. because I have two lists. Movies that I'm too scared to watch again, and this is on that list, or movies that I've never seen that I want to see. And I thought, you know what? I don't even remember this movie. So I think this could totally count as a bucket list. All I remember is being scared. Now, that said, I was clearly going into this expecting that it was not going to be very good, that it wasn't going to hold up, that it was probably going to be boring as hell. I think it's actually really, really good. Basically, what happens is it's about Betty and Barney Hill, and they go to a hypnotist because on their way back from Montreal, there are 36 minutes of their lives missing between these two mysterious sets of beeps. They don't remember what happened. And this film kind of shows you through flashback how this incident, this missing 36 minutes, affected their lives, like their marriage. They had a very happy marriage. Like I said, despite the prejudice, they truly loved each other. Everything was hunky-dory, and then this happened. And the film opens with them being obsessed, going back to this spot, driving up and down this thing of road to see if they can figure out what the hell happened to them. There are a lot of unsettling things in this. The overall arc of the story is actually one of a drama. And in fact, it actually does have a super cheesy 1975 TV movie ending. Super cheese, which for me just kind of ruined the whole thing. There's some nice moments. They do a lot of weird things after this experience, and they try to just block it out and pretend it didn't happen. But, you know, after the event, spoiler alert, they come back to the house and they're doing weird stuff like taking off their clothes and leaving them in the yard. You know, it's just bizarre things like that. And those were some of the things that scared me as a kid. And then there's these moments where, you know, they have Barney says, oh, I have scuffed shoes and he can't remember how. They both talk about three dots, three mysterious warts that appear on their groins that I have a memory. I could swear that I saw those three dots. That was one of the few memories I had of this movie. And the scene wasn't even in there. And I was like, it was not even in there. And I did research to find out if something was cut. No, they never shot that. It was never in there. That was my freaking 6-year-old mind going nuts, making up things that, you know, with my imagination. And I thought it was actually.
Could it have been in a different film and you just, your memory transposed it?
No, I don't think so. Cause I don't think I've ever seen another film. Every time I think about it, like I can see the dots in my head. And I remember because shortly thereafter I had to get my TB test at school. And when they did that, I kind of freaked out because it reminded me of the warts that the aliens put on their groins.
And they did.
Again, this was all in my head. They never did it.
Yeah. If they did the TB test on your groin, you might have a lawsuit.
Okay. Well, they didn't. They did on my own. Still, it was the dots that scared me. It was the image. And I remember going home all screaming and crying. And my parents were like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, they had no idea what was going on.
Your parents said that to you a lot, didn't they?
Yeah, they really did. They really did not understand me very well. But like I said, it's really a love story about how their love survives. You know, there's a whole lot of addressing of James Earl Jones plays Barney. And Estelle Parsons plays Betty. And in fact, James Earl, it's fun to watch James Earl Jones, and it's awesome that he's in this movie because some of the scariest moments in this film are when he is under hypnosis and he is repeating every thought that he walked through as these aliens were abducting them. And it is terrifying to watch. And watching it now as a 49, almost 49 year old adult, I understand why I think I was so terrified. You're seeing this big man like James Earl Jones, you know, deep voice, all of this, and he's crying and he's hysterical And he's, you know, just sobbing and breaking things and screaming like a little girl in terror. And I thought, you know, that must have been really terrifying for me to watch as a kid, because when you're like 5 or 6 years old and you're a little girl in particular, who do you look up to? You look up to your dad, right? So to sit there and see this man that, like, who's like your dad, you know, all strong and awesome and all this, and he's all just a big mess and crying, and that must have been really disturbing for me, I imagine. Do I recommend this movie? The special effects hold up. The alien effects are extremely simple. It is obviously people with, like, some kind of, you know, I don't know, plastic bag or vinyl or something over their faces. But it's the way it's shot. They actually are extremely creepy, because every time you see them, it's in shadow and you're not really sure what you're looking at. And the other thing this movie does well is that they don't always show you the aliens. A lot of times what they show you instead is the reaction that Barney and Betty are having to what's being done to them. There is some body horror that you don't see, but it's implied. There is, I mean, this, for the creepy parts of this movie, it's actually done very well. So I would recommend it, particularly if you're a fan of the alien abduction genre. However, I will tell you that in the last 15 minutes, the film shifts point of view. I'm not going to say how, because I don't want to spoil it, but it shifts POV and it takes on a different tone. And then it kind of has a cheesy, like I said, 1970s TV movie ending. But I do recommend it. I don't know. I really like it. I think the creepy stuff is really well done. So that's all I'm going to say. And anybody else have thoughts?
Yeah, Chrissy, first, where did you get to rewatch this? Because this is one of those films that has no release. I know it's on YouTube, though.
Yeah. Just Google it on YouTube.
Yeah, so there's no like HD version disc or anything, right? Because I've been looking for this for years.
No. But Phil, we'll talk afterward, okay? About that particular thing. But yes, I do. You can get it on YouTube. So listeners, and it's not the greatest quality, but it is very clear, and you can see what's going on. So it's not like somebody ripped it off a videotape and it's all grainy and stuff. It's actually decent for what it is. Just Google UFO incident. And then in parentheses, put The Interrupted Journey, right? And it should come up, because that's the way it's labeled in YouTube. And if you can't find it, give me a shout and I'll grab you the link, because I saved the link. So
this, I've seen this film a number of times as a kid back in the 70s, including on Channel 38, the Movie Loft, where I saw a lot of great films like Taxi Driver and such. And this is the film that it may have influenced my horror opinion the most out of any film I've ever watched in horror, because this is the film that made me say the Greys are the best monster ever. I love the Greys, and it's specifically because of this film. It's creepy. It has awesome actors. I love the psychiatrist scenes and the tape recorder and all that going on. Estelle Parsons and James Earl Jones were already established back then too. So I don't have much memory of it, unfortunately, except that I remember it was scary as hell and that it was awesome. So I really can't add anything more. But it's been a film that I'm hoping that someone will release on Blu-ray one day so I can buy it and watch it again in, you know, great format.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, because like I said, this film, if you read about this movie and do a little research, it is really considered like kind of the beginning of this genre. And what's also interesting about it is they come on and they say it is based on a true story, because it is. And yes, there were controversies surrounding this. There was a whole thing about whether or not Betty kind of lied and made it up, and And then when they put Barney under hypnosis, he was simply remembering the things that Betty had told him. There was a whole thing about she drew this star map, but the stars that were actually in the map were not actually discovered by astronomers until 7 or 8 years later. So, you know, that's a swing for the this is true side. I mean, there's a lot of like controversy. So it's worth reading about this. There supposedly have been other movies, Phil, made about this, but I can't find any. I couldn't find any references. People were like, oh, you know, a lot of movies have been made on this on this particular incident. And I'm like, really? Because this is the only one I've ever heard of. So I don't know. I might actually do other research on it just because
yeah. that
itself fascinates me. But I would bet you, Phil, that we would find this film listed on Kinder Trauma. You know, the website Kinder Trauma, where people put things that scared the crap out of them when they were kids?
Oh, no, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, my God, it's great. Go to Kinder Trauma. And it's all stuff, like, out of the 70s and 50s and 60s, things that terrified kids. And it's a community. And people are like, oh, my God, do you know the name of this movie where the lady's hair was on fire? And somebody else will be like, oh, my God, yeah, it's this. And then they write an article about it. It's pretty cool. Check it out, Kinder Trauma. I'm betting it's on there. In fact, I'm going to go look right now because this traumatized a lot of little kids in the 70s. It was kind of disturbing. So,
now, Mike, have you ever seen this one?
I haven't seen it. I know the case of Betty and Barney Hill. You know, I was really into the UFO thing in the early 90s.
Me too.
It was a thing. It was a thing. It was a fad. You know, I'm not surprising that was around the time X-Files popped up. But I've never actually seen the film. I might end up checking it out, especially with James Earl Jones in it. If it's not an official release, if it's on YouTube, you know, Phil, you can always put, there's the internet browser on your Xbox. You just go watch it that way and still get to see it on your TV.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, you're absolutely right. Yeah, actually, you can do that with Apple TV, too, because you can download the – I have the YouTube app on my Apple TV as well. Yeah. What about you, Eric? Have you ever seen this?
Never heard of it. Never seen it. Like Mike was – I know the case because when I was late in high school, I actually wrote a paper on the whole UFO phenomenon and did a bunch of research, and that was a case that kept on coming up over and over.
Oh, cool.
So I'm familiar with those two people and what happened to them, but I've never heard of this movie before.
Right. It's kind of interesting, too, because back at that time, Estelle Parsons was the bigger of the two because she had, you know, been nominated for Academy Award for Bonnie and Clyde and a bunch of other stuff. And so she was huge, and that was like a big cast thing to call for the TV movie of the week. And James Earl Jones had kind of just begun his career. But yeah, it's definitely worth checking out, especially if it ever comes out on like an HD version. But yeah, it's I loved it as a kid. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up about that? Anything?
Well, just one other thing in that the idea of hypnosis as actual therapy was kind of new back then, too, I think, Phil. Wasn't it considered kind of new agey and out there and weird?
Yeah, it was. It was weird.
Yeah, it was very weird. So I think it's interesting that this movie is really one of those movies that truly is a snapshot in time. You know, it really is looking back in the past. The only thing missing is 50 million people smoking 50 million cigarettes. Otherwise, it is very true to its time. So anyway, that's it. That's all I got.
All right, very good. Very good. Yeah, but I would concur with Chrissy from my memory. Again, I haven't seen it for like since 1980 maybe, but it was awesome. All right, Mike, I think you're next, right?
Yeah, so one of the films that's been on the list since I first had this idea is one I went with, and I kind of had it down to two, and I went with this one for the very deep, soulful fact that it was only about 90 minutes long and the other one was over 2 hours. And this is the 1957, I think, Orson Welles film Touch of Evil.
Oh, yeah. It was Janet Leigh and Charlton Heston.
Yeah, and my guess is, if I had to take a guess, I would think that of the Dark Discussions crew, you would have been the only other person to have seen it.
Oh, yeah. I've seen this one.
No, I actually saw that.
You did? Okay. Chrissy?
No.
So Touch of Evil is a...
I think I have, if it's the one I'm thinking of, is part of it like in a Mexican city?
The one that has Mexican Charlton Heston. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Oh.
Yeah,
a Mexican Charlton Heston. I'm all over that.
Yeah, it's a
you are.
It is a really is a weird thing, and man, this would get people so upset if you were one of these very sensitive people trying to watch it now, because he's clearly got like black shoe polish in his hair and.
Oh my God! I definitely have to watch.
And
this.
got grease paint and the thin little mustache. And you know,
well,
and,
what else are they going to do? Get a Mexican to play the part?
That's the thing, though, is that Mexican can mean anything. It can mean Caucasian, like Salma Hayek, or it could mean, you know, a Native American. So anybody technically could play a Mexican.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, if John Wayne could play Gunga Din, I guess.
I mean, the great.
Oh my God, Phil, settle down.
Well, no, but
I was
Anthony
making a
Quinn,
joke.
Anthony
settle
Quinn
down.
And the guy
settle
that played
down.
Khan, right?
Settle
I mean,
down.
You're as Caucasian.
Settle down. Everything's okay.
Okay, fair enough.
It was a joke. Settle down.
Fair enough. Continue, Mike.
Yeah, but I haven't seen a lot of Welles' films. I think this is my fourth. If I'm counting correctly, I know it's a cliche, but I do really love Citizen Kane. I think it's a visually brilliant film, and especially way ahead of its time. It helps if you are able to put yourself in the context of the time. I know I don't watch a lot of truly classic 50s films. If I'm watching a 50s film, there's a good chance it's going to be a B film like The Phantom from 10,000 Leagues, or Them, or Tarantula, or something like that. But it still feels to me like just visually this was still ahead of its time. It's very famous for its opening shot, which starts with seeing someone put a bomb in the trunk of a car, and then it just tracks for several minutes, this car traveling through this Mexican border town, weaving in and out of the festivities going on, and we see Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh as newlyweds cross paths with the car on several occasions. And of course the car, you know, nowadays they could have the car blow up on screen, you know, but this is the '50s and they didn't have that kind of effects budget. So the car pulls off and you hear the explosion just as it leaves the screen. Right after crossing the border. And it's not just that it's an interesting shot because, you know, you didn't have steady cams back then. You really have to plan things out. Every shot in this film, I think, is beautifully composed. I've always found there's two basic types of black and white film. And there's one where everything is gray. And then there's the ones where everything is kind of high contrast, you know, a lot of very dark blacks and grays and a lot of very, very, a lot of whites and light colors. And that I always found, you know, much more interesting than the sort of we're in black and white because we can't afford color ones. And so you get some really, really striking images. I was reading a review and it said, you know, that the film, you know, Welles chose to put this in black and white because all the color is in the characters. I thought that was an interesting take on it. I don't know if that's intentional. It was really what Welles' idea was. But yeah, it is filled with a bunch of interesting characters. And it's weird because even the main story, or what you think of as the main story, which is the bomb plot, really is a side story to what ends up happening. As it turns out, the Charlton Heston character, Miguel Vargas, is a member of the Mexican version of drug enforcement. And with a Mexican bomb blowing up a car on American soil, he kind of gets involved in this. And Orson Welles is the American investigator, who is this sort of old, he's infirm. He's got, carries a cane through most of the film. He's got a bad limp, which tingles when he gets a clue or something odd like that, you know. But he's your sort of hard-boiled veteran detective. And they come to Loggerheads. And Charlton Heston eventually accuses him of planting evidence on the guy that may or may not have blown up the car. And everything kind of spirals out of control there. There are some places where they pull punches. There's stuff that happens to Janet Leigh as she's waiting at the hotel room for Charlton Heston.
That's the scariest part of the film.
So oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, Janet Leigh in hotels.
Oh, yeah, it's not good. And really, they could have made this so much worse than what happens to her in Psycho. Spoiler warning, they try to frame, the drug lords try to frame Heston and one of the things, as somebody who's actually involved in the drug trade. And so they basically abduct the wife and they inject her with, I think they injected her with Demerol, but they basically were trying to set it up to make it look like she was a drug whore and that, you know, and that he was a drug dealer. You know, they really could have raped her and injected her with heroin and done all these really horrible, horrible things to her that if this was made, oh, I don't know, by Gaspar Noé, that they probably would have done.
Or if it was just made today.
Yeah, you know, that today.
Yeah, but this was the 50s and they hadn't invented rape yet.
Yeah, that's true. But it was implied, you know, it's all implied, you know, but that you had a good drug dealer. You'd no touch the reefer, you know, it's just... and some of it's laughable, like, you know, them calling, you know, marijuana reefer and, you know, treating it like it's radioactive. But it's also, it's also the time, right? You know, it is the 50s. It's not today. And there, that was sort of the public perception. I don't know what the police's perception of marijuana was back then, you know, who actually had to come across it and dealt with people who were using it. But obviously it had a horrible, horrible reputation, and you'll go watch, like, you know, Reefer Madness if you want to laugh.
Oh, yeah, because didn't people think it made you, like, blind and, like, all this other shit?
Or crazy and all this, yeah, whatever. It was all anti-drug propaganda.
It made you want to have sex, too. I know that.
Well, you don't want a newlywed to have sex. We know that.
No.
I
don't know about you guys, but when I'm high, the only thing I want to do is sleep.
you do get Janet Leigh in some nice lingerie waiting around the hotel room.
You do.
And it's a film filled with some colorful characters. There's this really bizarre, almost distracting, guy who plays the night manager at the hotel. Entertaining to watch. He feels like he walked in from a completely different movie. But it's just strange. So it really does end up coming down to a conflict between these two law enforcement officials and the idea of the question of corruption and stuff like that. And they kind of offhandedly solve the bombing when they get a confession about the bombing at the end. With like 60 seconds to go, you know, just say, oh yeah, so-and-so confessed. Of course, we all know that you could beat a false confession out of anybody. So whether they really did or not, I don't know. I don't know if that was intended to be ambiguous or if it was intended to actually wrap up that plot line. I really like the film. It's definitely dated. Obviously, if you have, you know, you're dealing with drug gangs, the hoodlums are, you know, straight out of West Side Story with the greasy black hair and the black leather jackets. They're Hispanic, so they're more sharks than Jets. But yeah, it's and again, casting Charlton Heston as Miguel Vargas is probably going to rub some people the wrong way if you're going to be overly sensitive about that, or you look at it as the fact that he's an actor who's acting and playing a Mexican person without a trace of a Mexican accent, which would have probably
is Robert De Niro bad to play a Jew in a lot of his films? No, of course not. Is Dustin Hoffman bad to play Gentiles, an Italian?
Settle down.
You know what I'm saying.
Don't make us get the leash.
Don't make us get the taser.
Don't tase me, bro.
Don't tase me.
Yeah, right. The water bottle. Yeah, that's great. You remember they did that in The Office to Dwight. It was great.
I do think it's funny that you have the actor Victor Milan, who did a lot of stuff. When he was older, he was in the 83 version of Scarface, for example. He plays in an relatively early role, plays one of the young hoodlums. I highly recommend it. It is a film that's kind of ambiguous in a lot of ways. A lot of the characters are flawed. Even the Heston character, you know, while he comes across kind of as the upright crusader, he's also a guy who's abandoning his wife repeatedly during their honeymoon. I'm thinking it's their honeymoon. They are newlyweds. In order to go chase after the bad guys, and ends up putting her in danger because he keeps leaving her alone in a dangerous place. I would definitely recommend it if you are interested in film noirs. This is considered one of, if not the last, of the classics of the film noir period. Things like Body Heat, Maltese Falcon, the Big Sleep. So if you like that, if you like those sort of hard boiled detective films, this is a classic of the genre. And this is one of those examples of a movie where you could pause it almost at any point and get something, a picture that you could frame and put on a wall.
I would agree with that. Yep. Mike, a question for you. What was the other film you were considering?
The other film I was considering was North by Northwest.
Oh, that's the best film ever. Best film ever.
That's a great movie. Yeah,
it is supposed to be a great movie, and the only problem is that it's about your 40th best film ever. So,
no, this is probably my favorite genre film that's not horror is North by Northwest.
Lawrence of Arabia.
That's not a genre film. Well, that's a war film, but I don't call it genre.
Right, you said it's not genre.
No, not horror.
Oh, genre film. I got it. Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. North by Northwest is my number one non-horror genre film.
And really, I just saw it was a 2 hour and 30 minute film, and I just didn't quite have time for that.
I had no idea it was that long because it flies. It's that good.
I'm sure. And if we were doing this like a week earlier and I was still on my Christmas break, that'd be a whole different story. I probably would have watched it.
I actually had that as one of our listener choices when we do those polls on Facebook. North by Northwest was one of those films that I put on it. It did not win.
And I have a lot of Hitchcock films I have never gotten to. So, I mean, I could do this for, you know, about a decade and just do Hitchcock films. And that's not counting the films that I want to rewatch, like The Trouble with Harry, that I thought was hysterically funny in a very dark and morbid way, and I'm just curious to see if I still find it that way.
Now, did you watch the extended version of this film? Because you said you only watched, because there's an hour and 11 minute version of the film that came out in 1998 where they cobbled together the original cut, I guess?
I think this is, well, it wasn't I did some reading about it afterwards. It's a 98 minute version. The 111 minute version is the one that was in 98. I don't know if any of them are truly a definitive thing. This is I'm guessing this is the original theatrical release.
Sure.
I'm much more inclined now to pick up the special edition DVD that has all the cuts and watch it again and and maybe catch it with a commentary track and see some of the things that they said. And I'm curious how he pulled off some of the camera work he did, given the limitations they would have had at the time. They do a really good job because it is still a lot of stuff is set on sound stages. You can tell if you have a good eye for it, you can tell like there's scenes of men standing there talking in front of a painted backdrop or a photographic backdrop, as opposed to actually being on location. Or it certainly seems that way. But there's still other things like the camera going up through an elevator, and you know, changing floors, which is easy, I think a little bit easier to do now and might not have been as easy to do then. But anyway, and also just some of the performances, some of the actors, because there's a lot of character actors I know I've seen in other things before, and I haven't had a chance to look them up. So I would highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a solid film. Solid film for sure. And really well made. And Orson Welles is awesome. And great cast and all that. North by Northwest is still way better. But, yeah, this is a good film. Good film. Now, Eric, you said you... Go on. Sorry.
I was going to say, Eric, you said you saw it. So what did you think of it?
It was a while ago. My memory. What's a mummery? My memory is a little fuzzy, but I remember enjoying it. I think I mainly watched it because I was curious because Judas Priest has a song by the same title. They're not about the same thing.
was the Judas Priest song about masturbation?
No, it doesn't. So I enjoyed the movie. I don't have clear memories of it. I remember being impressed with the filmmaking because that was when I was of the opinion that anything black and white must be uninteresting. But I definitely was interested when I was watching the movie.
Very good, very good. What about you, Chrissy? You mentioned that you have not seen it. Is that right?
No, I have not. So, but I'm putting it on my list because it just honestly sounds like a whole ton of fun.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty solid. All right. Anybody else? Any further things on that one? Anyone? All right. Very well. Let's see. I do have a new urge to see North by Northwest, though, so I'm thinking of buying a Blu-ray for that.
And that's what you got out of Mike's review of A Touch of Evil.
Yes.
Yes.
What the fuck?
Well, yeah. North by Northwest is so awesome, dude.
I got bad news for you, Phil. All those copies of North by Northwest, they burned them all.
Oh, burn it! Burn it all!
Except for
burn
the one that you sent all. To me.
Which means you're never getting it back, Phil. Eric's just going to torture you and say, ha, ha, ha.
No, I think it was a birthday present, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Can I ask you guys something? What about Niagara? That was a Hitchcock one, too, wasn't it? Was it Niagara? Or was that
No, that's not Hitchcock, but it's a film noir. I think that's Billy Wilder, maybe? I can't remember.
Maybe. I know that's one that I think I honestly
that's a pretty good one.
1953... directed by Henry Hathaway, produced by Charles Brackett.
Yeah. Henry Hathaway, starring Joe Cotton and Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, Marilyn Monroe was in it. I want to say I saw that the same night that I saw North by Northwest. For some reason, Charles and I watched them together.
The poster is a giant Marilyn Monroe laying down on Niagara Falls.
Yeah. Well, that's
disturbing. Sex sells. You got to do it. That is an awesome poster, by the way. Yeah.
What's your movie, Phil?
Oh, yes.
No.
Okay, well, originally I was going to do Bucket of Blood because the Blu-ray just came out fully restored and all that. Like a couple months ago, I bought it. Dick Miller passed away and Roger Corman's film, and I had never seen it. But then I decided I was going to do a film because Mike was busting me about it on one of the the last episode, I think, that we released, which was The Princess Bride. So I was going to watch that. But then me and Mike were
you
going
You do have
back.
To watch that, by the way. That and This is Spinal Tap.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that one either. And then me and Mike were going at it on Facebook the other day. And so
As usual.
So I decided to do the 1944 film noir film Gaslight.
Okay.
I had never seen it, but it was always on one of my lists to see. And then since me and Mike were talking about it back and forth, where every time he attacked me, I said he's gaslighting me. I said, you know what? I'm going to do that film. So I switched a couple nights ago a third time. And so basically, it's about, this woman, 14-year-old girl whose famous aunt dies and she was real close to her. The aunt was like an opera singer. It takes place in London. And so she was murdered and all her jewels are gone. And so now that she lost her guardian, she was sent off to Paris to become an opera singer too. But so they fast forward 6 years later, and as the age of 22, she's just not good as a singer. She looks identical to her aunt, but she just doesn't have the voice. So she decides to do a more conventional life, and she marries this French guy who, bourgeois type guy, and they decide to move to London. And since she inherited that house where her aunt died, he suggests to move there, even though she doesn't want to because all the bad memories of losing her aunt. But she agrees since it's free, obviously. And then weird things begin to happen where she hears that, well, they lock all this stuff up in the attic to, you know, her aunt's stuff. So they don't, so she doesn't like have nightmares of her aunt continuously. So suddenly she starts hearing footsteps up in the attic all the time. And the title of the film, Gaslight, comes from back in those days. They used gaslight instead of electric bulbs to light the house. So what would happen is, out of the blue, all the gas lights in her family room or her bedroom where she is would suddenly dim. And she would mention this to her husband, and he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So she starts beginning to think she's going insane because she's hearing things in the attic and the gas lights kind of fade out all the time. And eventually she starts becoming a kleptomaniac. Things have been again stolen and she has possessions of it. And so she thinks she's going nuts and may have to be committed. But again, this is a 1944 film, so it's very old, so spoilers, here they come. What it is the husband used to be married to the aunt, murdered the aunt to get her jewels, but couldn't find the jewels. So 6 years later, when she became of age, he targeted the niece. And so that's how he got to get back into the house, so he can find where those jewels are hidden. And what would happen is, he was trying to get her committed, so then he would inherit the house without having to worry about people kind of watching over him while he's doing searching. And what it was is, it was him upstairs trying to find stuff in the attic while she was in bed and she was hearing the noises. And what he would do, since everybody thought the attic was empty, he would turn on the gas lights upstairs for lighting in the middle of the night. And what that would happen is, every time you turn on a gas light, it takes away gas from other lanterns. And so that's why it was dimming. And then he was putting things in her purse and stuff and saying, and making her think she was a kleptomaniac and whatnot. So the term gaslighting, which people may know, especially nowadays, it's with the feminist movement back in stride with the Me Too's and whatever. Gaslighting has become a term that's been very, very common now, where even though in this case it's a patriarchy thing, anybody can be gaslit. Basically, you do things. But someone asked this on the Scares That Care page, what gaslighting means, and I gave an example. I said basically, you could be cleaning your house and find and move a figurine from the mantle and put it on the coffee table, and then when your husband comes home, he would say, "This what this? I don't remember this being here." And she said, "Yeah, you remember? You moved it there the other day." And he would eventually go, "Yeah, maybe I did." That's gaslighting. So,
yeah, it's basically, Phil, what it is it's basically convincing someone that they don't know the truth, like that your version of the truth is the truth and theirs is not. That's kind of the easiest. Yeah,
yeah, so basically convincing someone that they did something or believe something that isn't true. And an excellent example of that recently was the great film, in my opinion, A Girl on the Train, starring Emily Blunt. That film is an excellent example of gaslighting. And that's where the term comes from. It comes directly from this movie, which was a remake of a 1940 film from the UK, which was a adaptation of a 1938 play called Gaslight. And so the movie won seven. I'm not. Let me rephrase that. It had seven Academy Award nominations, including the 18-year-old actress in her, I think, her first role, Angela Lansbury, was nominated as a supporting actress. Actually, the film stars Ingrid Bergman, Charles Boyer, and Joseph Cotten, which we just talked about from Niagara. So it's considered, I think it was in 2017, it was put into the National Archives as an important film. However, I will say that it's very dated, and I think it's a very flawed film because the mystery is ruined so quick that you know the guy's a bad guy pretty much almost by the 20-minute mark, and then they show.
Is it supposed to be a mystery, though?
You know, that's a good question, Eric. You would. It is kind of because you know something's up, but you don't know what it is. But you know he is the reason, and you don't know why. So there is a couple of things, like you don't find out until later that he was actually the husband of the opera singer, and he had changed his name and all this other stuff and his identity. But the film would have been a lot better if you didn't know he was the villain and just maybe a jerk. So I felt that was unfortunate.
Are you supposed to know that he's trying to drive her crazy? Because I mean, the problem with the title of the film is that it has now become in the last couple of years, especially, become such a ubiquitous term that it's kind of hard not to know it just from the title, right? The title is a spoiler.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. Oh, right. Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Unfortunately, you kind of know he's bad even because without the title. So if this was called something else and we didn't know what gaslighting was, you kind of know that he's kind of up to no good pretty quick. Basically, what happens is when they first move into the house, and this is like 20 minutes in, they're looking through the aunt's old stuff and, you know, what they're going to move up to the attic. And she finds a note in a music book, because obviously, you know, she did opera and whatnot. And she starts reading it, and he freaks out and he screams and rips the note from her and all this other stuff, you know. And so right there, you know, okay, there's something fishy. When they could have just had him, they could have made it a nice checkoff gun where he goes, "Oh, please, darling, don't read this. Come on, let's go out to dinner," or whatever. And then he just pockets the thing. But him flipping out kind of ruined the checkoff gun, I felt, of what the note said and what it was going to mean and whatnot. And basically the note was his note to the prior wife that he murdered, using his false name of that era. And so, you know, right there, you already know, okay, it's, I don't know. It was just unfortunate, I felt. So I figure the film's more important for the term gaslighting than the actual quality of the film, because a lot of film noirs from that era are much, much better films.
No, I knew what that term meant, but did not realize its origin until just tonight. So that's cool.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 It comes from the gaslights lowering and him lying and saying, "No, you're mistaken. You must be imagining things." And then she goes, "Oh, yeah, maybe you're right. I am imagining things." And that's gaslighting. So would I recommend the film? Yeah, I would recommend it for the importance of the film. For, you know, it's, I mean, it is Academy Award nominated 7 times and whatnot. It does have an 87% on Rotten Tomato, which is a little lower for a classic film. A lot of the classic films around 96, 95. So, and I think that's correct, because it's definitely not as good as, you know, The Godfather and things like that. I would say that I did read stuff about the 1940 version. Some people think is better, but again, since it was a true British production rather than a Hollywood one, it's not as well known. But I haven't seen that one. And it obviously doesn't have the stars appeal of this one here. I must say Angela Lansbury by far was the best actor in the film. She was incredible. And I could see why she would eventually become a powerhouse in B films and then finally a TV star in the later years. Never mind her Disney career after that. It's always good to see Joe Cotton, but I felt his role was very forgettable. He plays the hero, and yet he's kind of like secondary to the point where he's not on screen enough, which is kind of bizarre. Bergman was really good. And I felt Charles Boyer was fantastic, except he had to give away the twists way too early, and that's not his fault. It's the scripts. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I don't know. You see, it appears that none of you have seen it before, I guess, right?
I have. No, that is correct. I've not seen
it. I've never seen it either.
What did you say, Mike? Did you say you saw it?
No. Okay. And weirdly, I didn't have much interest in watching it because the description of the story just didn't grab me, especially knowing the twist or whatever it is. It just
And that's the thing. It's like I would like to recommend it. I mean, technically, you know, I mean, it's important for
cultural impact,
but and both because of the Academy Award nominations and what it has done now, even though you can argue that, you know, the play, the original play, which only came out a few years prior, was the real place the term come from. But yeah, like Mike, you said, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, I mean, it's very slow, and the thriller part aspect of it really isn't that thrilling. And you know, right from the beginning, who the bad guy is, even if the term gaslighting hadn't become so prevalent, so you would guess. In other words, they let you know this guy's a bad guy right from the beginning. I just felt that was unfortunate. But I don't know. But yeah, that's it. Maybe I would have been better off checking out Bucket of Blood or Princess Bride. Yeah, that's all I got. Anything else? Anyone?
Nobody else has seen it, so we don't really have anything to say.
No problems. I will just say a couple things. Charles Boyer, he was an Academy Award nominated actor like 3 times in his career. He's from France, so in real life. So he was actually playing a Frenchman. Ingrid Bergman, everybody knows. I don't have to talk about her. Swedish actress. Joe Cotton. He was a big actor back in that era. Starred in Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. Came out of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater, the radio shows that he did, and then made a hell of a good career as a leading man for years, and then eventually a supporting actor into the 1970s and 80s and such. I think one of his last films he ever did was Soylent Green. He played the wealthy guy that gets killed at the near the beginning of that film. And then, of course, Angela Lansbury in one of her first films as an 18-year-old. It's very odd because she looks very much different than anything.
Yeah, I got to know her from Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
So like seeing an older thing with her in it where she's a looker is like, whoa, hey, all right, Angela Lansbury.
Yeah. Yeah, it's odd. I remember seeing her in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and Manchurian Candidate and now in this film. And yet, like you said, I'm so used to seeing her in Murder, She Wrote. And then even when I saw her in the most recent Emily Blunt film, Mary Poppins Returns, whatever it was called, and she's wicked old in that, it was weird too, because she's just like always that same person from Murder, She Wrote to me. And then when you see her
in
these books,
I feel the same way, because that's exactly where I kind of got to know her, was that. And, so in my mind, seeing her, like you said, young and beautiful is like, oh, my God, really? Is what?
Yeah, right.
Because we were all so kids, too. When she was in Murder, She Wrote, we were all what? Early teens?
Yeah.
Maybe? Like
about that. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little bit different than, say, the adults would look at her and would know who she was. You know what I mean? Like, for us, it was like she was just always Murder, She Wrote. She was never anything else, So. Yeah,
exactly. One other actress in this film, Dame Mae Whitty, who plays the neighbor and Joe Cotton's, I think, mother in this film or aunt. I had never seen her in any other film except one other prior to this, because she was way back in those era. But she was in Mrs. Miniver, and that film is like one of my favorite dramas of all time. So it was kind of good to see her again in this film here. So anybody who's seen Mrs. Miniver, Mary Whitty, or Dame Mary Whitty, is in this film as well, Gaslight. All right, so that's it. We got the five films. Abe did Kaufman's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Eric, what one were you did again?
The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, that's right. And Chrissy, what do you do?
The UFO Incident.
And Mike?
Touch of Evil.
And I did Gaslight. All right, so I guess we can go around and discuss maybe some news and things of that nature, movies we've seen, anything like that. Eric, you got anything that you wanted to let folks know about that you may have seen?
I have been watching a shit ton of movies. Let's see. Let's start with a movie called Freaks that I watched. I don't want to say much about it because there is a little bit of a reveal. I will say it's not 100% original, but it takes a premise that's been used before and executes it well. So I'd recommend
watching
Freaks. Is that the one with Freaks?
With the girl on the, on the cover? Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
I saw that too. It's horror adjacent. It's definitely more science fiction, but it kind of goes, shall we say, the dangerous kids theme of the 2019.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a movie because Mr. Watson pestered me into watching it, called The Laplace's Demon. I liked it, but didn't love it. A lot of other people are gushing about it. I think it was well shot, but the story didn't particularly do it for me. Actually, no, it's not even that. The story was cool. It was just there was one aspect of the movie that I was supposed to be scary that I did not find scary at all. That's what didn't do it for me. But I think other people might like it a lot, The Laplace's Demon. I watched Antrim, the deadliest movie ever made. I liked it. I can see people hating it. It's going to be a coin flip, depending on who you are, I think. I will just say that I liked it. I'm not necessarily going to recommend it for everybody. So it is what it is. I watched a movie called Apparition, which is god awful. Do not watch this movie. It's awful.
Oh my gosh. Can I interrupt? Is it the one with they do with the house that's coming out of that? I think I saw that and it was really bad.
It's about contacting the dead with a cell phone app.
Yes. Yeah. No,
yeah, it's so bad.
Oh my god, it is really bad. You know, and I'll put up with a bad ghost movie more than most people. This thing I was just like, okay, really? That is however many minutes of my life I am not getting back. And I almost didn't make it to the end.
It's a decent premise, and then they just crapped all over it with a horrible script and bad acting. Anyway, yeah, avoid that one. I finally got to see Parasite. Last weekend, I actually bought a ticket and was going to go see The Grudge, and then noticed almost by accident that Parasite was still showing in the theater in my area. So I went to see that instead. It is an excellent movie.
How did you do that? Did you just sneak in? Because even though you already bought a ticket, so it doesn't matter.
No, I just paid for a ticket I didn't use.
Gotcha.
I bought a ticket to Parasite. it's a Korean movie, so there are subtitles, but don't let that scare you. It's a good movie. I don't think I would consider it to be a horror movie, but it's just an excellent movie, so you should check it out.
Yeah, it's very much a black comedy, mm-hmm. I think, and a satire.
Well, and it's got tons of social commentary.
Yeah.
So if that's your thing, check it out. I watched a movie at Phil's recommendation called Light of My Life. I did not like it as much as Phil does. I think it's a good movie, but he was really, really, really excited about it, and I don't get that from it. I thought it was a fairly slow drama that was acted fine, but I didn't find the story particularly interesting. Then I watched Bloodline, which is a movie that stars Sean William Scott. Clearly inspired by Dexter, but well executed. And I enjoyed that. I watched, I think it's a Korean movie called A Record of Sweet Murder. I actually bought that one on disc. I heard about it on the Exploding Heads Horror Movie Podcast. And a couple of those guys had it on their best of list for the year. I bought the disc because apparently Mr. Watson went out and tried to buy it on or rent it on Vudu, and somehow ended up with a copy that did not have subtitles, and was going through some rigmarole to try and get a file with subtitles and sync it up with the video, and I didn't want to deal with any of that, so I just bought a copy from Amazon and watched it. That is, it's a found film, found footage movie. And I don't really want to say much about it, because if you like it, you're going to like it.
What's the title of it again, Eric?
It's called A Record of Sweet Murder.
Okay, and you said it's found footage. I'll check it out.
And the premise is basically that this woman who's a journalist gets contacted by somebody she knows from childhood who's committed a string of murders, and he wants to tell his story. That's basically how I would set it up. And then I watched an Indian movie called Tumbad that's available on Amazon Prime Video. Indian movies are interesting because every once in a while just a song happens. But I wouldn't say I loved it, but I liked it. And for a long time, I was just trying to figure out where the heck the whole thing was going. And then it's unique. I'll give it that. I don't know if the mythology put forth in the story is based on anything that's actually in Indian mythology or not, because I don't know anything about that. But it's definitely mythological in feel, because it involves goddesses and their children and so on and so forth. So I liked it. A lot of people are flipping out about it. I just liked it. I didn't love it, but I would still recommend checking it out, especially since it's on Prime, which most people have available. So yeah, that's what I've been watching.
Have you watched Daniel Isn't Here or whatever it's called?
Yeah, I talked about that on a previous episode.
Yeah, that's right. You did. Yeah, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I know Mike has seen Tom Bad, and I have seen half of it. I think that the cinematography was absolutely phenomenal, especially for such a low budget film. Because I read that it was only like $50,000, mm-hmm. And the landscapes and the cinematography during the night is, mm-hmm. is almost like Hollywood professional. It's that good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't really like the story that much. I was confused a bit. Mike explained some of it to me, and it makes sense.
It explains it as you go through the film. It's kind of a mystery to it, I think, Eric. Not like a murder mystery, but
no. Novel. And for the first 30 minutes of the movie, I wasn't up to speed with the story they were telling, and then finally it clicked in for me. I was like, oh, well, that's weird, but I get it now.
Yeah. it felt weird that how the people acted too. I felt they wouldn't act like real people, but go on, Mike. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a case of being from a different culture that, you know, and I've mentioned this before, like if you watch an American watching an American or European vampire film, you know everything you need to know just because it's a vampire film, right? I don't know if I was Indian, if I would immediately understand everything that was going on right away. Or if it was deliberately structured to be something where you're supposed to put the pieces together as the film goes along, you know. But for me, that worked. And I just find I've been liking a lot of these foreign films because they hit different things than what I'm used to necessarily. And I do think the opening is particularly creepy. The ending worked for me. Maybe I have a thing for
the ending was my favorite part. Yeah.
And it absolutely is a film that has a moral message, but it's like a moral message that you would get from like, Brothers Grimm story. Right. You know, it's not, this isn't
greed is bad.
Right. It's all about greed, and that's the story. It's very simple. This isn't about, like, you know, the fight for 15 or something like that. It's not, you know, contemporary. It's a classic morality play that you would tell a child, and, you know, you just use it to, and that's why you shouldn't be a greedy little shit, you child, because, you know, your whole family might end up being murdered, you know, or something along those lines.
Right.
Let's fight for 15, Mark.
Oh, it's for $15 minimum wage.
Oh, I see. Oh, gotcha. You're talking about politics. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So it's an interesting film, but I would agree, even though it wasn't necessarily for me, I would agree that it's worth checking out, especially if it's free on Amazon and most people have it, as you said, Eric. And I know, Mike, you said you kind of liked it a lot. I know Jason Lloyd loved it too. So people like it, yeah.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. It is going to be high on my year-end list. And, you know, spoiler warning that when was it Rachel who had asked for our 50 best films for the 2010s?
Yeah.
I did put that and one other movie from 2019 on that list because I'm reluctant to put anything from 2019 on because it's so recent. But
you didn't order yours though, right? You just wrote your
title. I just put them in alphabetical order. I didn't put them in a particular order.
Yeah, I actually kind of put mine in in numeric order, even though some of them would switch around. But my first was Take Shelter was still my first. My top 10 are pretty solid. My top 10
and that's not a horror movie, Phil.
Well, it depends on your
definition. No, you're just wrong. It's not a horror movie.
Take Shelter. I put that as my best horror
film. Yeah, well, it's like people who say Parasite is a horror film. It's not. It's not even remotely.
Wow. Like,
one person is killed in Parasite. That's it.
Well, I haven't seen that one, so I can't. Yeah. Anything else, Eric?
That's everything I've been watching.
All right. For me, I saw Light of My Life. My wife found it on Prime and mentioned it to me, and I was surprised that it was a 2019 film. Casey Affleck stars, directs, and wrote it, and co-produced it. Post-apocalyptic. I love this film. I thought it was.
I don't know if that term is accurate, Phil.
All right. Well, the society's collapsed, right? I mean, it's post-apocalyptic.
Not entirely.
Well, it's not.
How collapsed does it have to be to count as collapsed?
90% of all females are dead. That's pretty post-apocalyptic, if you ask me, Eric. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah,
all right. I guess it depends on your definition of apocalypse.
Well,
less than 50% of the population was killed, so I don't know if I call that an apocalypse.
It's societal apocalypse.
Well, it's sort of like...
Anyway, go on.
Let's put it, how about pre-apocalypse? Because it's kind of like Children of Men.
Pre-apocalypse. Well, there you go. It's not post-apocalypse. It's pre-apocalypse.
Which, by the way, Blake, pretty much applies to every film that isn't actual apocalypse or post-apocalypse. But
true. Well, it's kind of like that Evan Rachel Wood and... the chick that played Juno, that film, Into the Woods. You remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that, and kind of like The Road. It was a combination of The Road and Into the Woods mixed together. Kind of sort of.
Oh, no, in a certain manner. Yeah. It's not nearly as bleak.
To the forest. Yeah, I mean, but either way, so I'm trying to decide whether it's horror or not. I was talking to Barrett Heisner, co-worker that I work with.
It's not horror.
And he says it's horror. He considers it horror.
It's not horror.
I have to consider it. I may have to consider it horror.
Okay. By the way, I just looked up the definition of apocalypse.
Yeah.
The complete final destruction of the world is described in the biblical book of Revelation. Although the second definition is an event involving destruction or damage on an awesome or catastrophic scale.
Well, if you wipe out...
I guess you can say that.
Yeah. Right, because if you stick with the first definition, right, then you can't use it for something like the robot apocalypse, because I'm pretty sure they didn't mention robots in the Bible. I don't think there's...
What version are you reading?
Right. This one here, it says, film follows a man who must protect his daughter by disguising her as his son after a plague wiped out most of the female population. So, that's kind of post-apocalyptic, kind of.
Yeah, but it's not horror.
Well, there's some pretty horrific stuff in it.
That's not horror.
Apocalypse films are one of those things that kind of, depending on the specifics, they're not horror, but they're often horror adjacent. Because they're playing on kind of those fears.
Yeah, like, would The Road be considered horror, right?
Yeah, it would be depressing.
It's close. Yeah, you know, it's debatable. I mean, I got to figure it out.
More nasty stuff in The Road than there is in this movie.
Well, they have the cannibals in that one, you're right. But this one is pretty horrific. It's good stuff.
Please, you know what? I figured it out. I know what it's called. It's elevated horror. It's all elevated horror.
There you go. But either way, Light of My Life, I recommend. And if you have Prime, similar to Tumbad, you can watch it for free. It's a really good film, in my opinion. I also watched this TV show called You, Y-O-U.
Oh, my God. Phil, did you watch the first season? Oh, my God, it's awesome.
I finished the first season, and I just started the second. The first season, the first five episodes are awesome, and then 6 through 9, it kind of falls off the rails a little bit, but then episode 10 is awesome. But as a whole season, it's really good. The second season, I've seen the first episode, and it was pretty good. My neighbor, this South Korean woman that lives on my street, well, she's American now. We talk about Korean films all the time, but she, out of the blue, started talking about all this stuff that's not Korean. And she said the second season of You is better than the first. So, and it's a huge twist.
That's weird. When the first season came out, people were ripping on it. So I never bothered to check it out. And then now all of a sudden season 2 comes out and everybody's like heaping praise on it. So I don't know what to think.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's the thing. Here's what I'm going to tell you, and I'm probably going to get shot for this, but I honestly, I'm getting to the age where I don't give a shit anymore. The thing with You is that it is highly intelligent, and it's very dark. So what happened was people that maybe, you know, kind of a little lower on the intellect scale didn't get it. Okay, and we're like, well, I don't understand. Like, this guy is like a stalker, but he's not. I don't get it. So, yeah, I'm serious. This is what people said to me at work, and I was like, dude, you know what? Go home and watch the Flintstones, because that's all you're capable of handling. So, anyway, what ended up happening was the second season, so a bunch of people, like, got on board the first season and started talking about it. And then they kind of started, I sort of watched this happen. It was kind of amazing. Then they started talking about it and started convincing people that were maybe not, you know, with it the first time around. Oh no, this is what it means. This is how it works. Then those people would go watch and go, oh, now that I understand it, it's good. See? And so then they all watched the first season and now they watch the second season.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll check it out.
Yeah, what happened? It's not for everybody. It's that I will definitely say. It's not. There are people that I know, very good friends of mine, was like, dude, I tried to get into it. I just couldn't. I loved it because I just thought it was right up my alley.
The best part of it is its commentary on how people suck, Eric. Because like, there's this girl, Annika, who is friends of one of the main characters, and when he describes her, because there's a lot of, you know, narration in his head, and he goes, oh, she's smart enough to show enough boob on social media to get all the guys to watch, but then she talks about all these other things to get the girls to watch, like woman power, and so she's so powerful on social media because she uses the boobs for the guys and the cutesy things that women want to hear about empowerment. You got to see it. I'm not giving it justice.
I'm not going to give it a spoiler.
I'll watch at least a few episodes.
But I will say this. The thing that makes this so interesting is that your central character, the guy whose point of view this is from, you really feel like you should not like him for various reasons. And yet you really end up liking him a lot. So it's this very complex relationship.
Yeah, it's like,
so
Dexter.
Like Dexter.
Exactly.
Like Dexter, but I, you know what? I got to say, I like this way better than Dexter. Dexter was kind of like, I don't know, it just kind of bored me. This just is a lot more interesting, I think.
The character
is just so much like he's so complex, and then he'll say something crazy and you're just like, what the fuck? But then you stop and think and you go, oh no, wait, that does make sense, you know, and you start to scare yourself because you start to think like he does. It's really a good time. So
the difference between the two characters is Dexter had dissocial personality disorder, but he wasn't insane any other way. Well, this guy has dissocial personality disorder, but he also has like schizophrenia every so often. It's weird. Like Chrissy, when he's talking to his ex-girlfriend.
Yes.
Candace, you know, those scenes. So there's some, so he's has some more issues, but generally, it's the same thing where it's a character like Dexter where you don't supposed to like, but you kind of do because the character's so awesome. If that makes sense,
right? Well, and the other thing is too, like I said, where this show is intelligent is the way that this guy thinks and his perception on people.
Because he may be a criminal himself, but he sees through everybody. He says that person's this a phony because of this reason. You know, I mean, he's almost like Holden Caulfield, but a murderer. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it is weird. Like, I love the ones when he goes, "Oh, and you are dumb." Right. You know, it's just like in his head. He said, "It's fantastic. Right. It's great." It's so. Anyway, and Eric, I would love to know what you thought about it. And I didn't mean to jump in, Phil, but that was the only thing I've been watching because I've been so busy with other stuff. So I'm done.
I'll have a chance soon, but I'll watch some at least eventually.
For folks who are curious, it was a Lifetime original. But they didn't pick up the second season, and so Netflix picked up the show similar to that.
I was just reading up on it. Its ratings were much better on Netflix than they were on Lifetime.
Yeah. The ratings by Rotten Tomatoes were equal, but yeah, they didn't – when it was on Lifetime –
No, not the score, the ratings, the viewership.
Right, the viewership, because Lifetime – not everybody watches Lifetime, but everybody watches Netflix. So that's how like Breaking Bad became popular, right? Because once it showed up on Netflix, everybody started watching it. You know, Sons of Anarchy, all these shows. So same thing here, where when it was on Lifetime, you know, most people don't watch Lifetime except, you know, a handful. And then when it goes to Netflix and they pump it up, everybody just starts watching it. I mean, if you go to Netflix Facebook page right now, they're picture at the top of the page is the U poster, so they're really pushing it even on Facebook. So what else? Oh, and I saw Under the Silver Lake, which I know you've seen, Eric. It's by the director of It Follows. I was talking
about. Yeah, I did care for it.
Yeah, I know you said you didn't really like it. I could see how some people wouldn't like it, but I thought it was fantastic. It had a lot of black humor, and it works, I felt. And the mystery was kind of cool, and it leaves a lot of things that are open-ended. But it's a commentary on Hollywood, similar to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. If people ever wanted to do a double feature, that film and Under the Silver Lake would be a great double feature, in my opinion, because of its commentaries on Hollywood and how it looks at women in Hollywood and people and all this other stuff and everything about Hollywood. So it's kind of a surreal film because, you know, you're wondering if it's just the guy's crazy, but it actually is not one of those in his head. It's actually all occurring. And it is cool. Like there's one scene that's hilarious. He sees somebody that he knows in the middle of the night, and he decides to follow them, and it lands up at this mansion party that's going on, you know, with Hollywood people, whatever. And he just walks in, and they let him in, and he's in his pajamas still. And people say, "Hey, man, I love your shirt, and I love your pants." You know, so it's like winking at us, like, here's this hip party and this guy goes in his pajamas and no one notices and they just think he's hip, you know, a hipster. And it's stuff like that, the little humor in it. But if you like thrillers, it's pretty solid, I felt. But I could see, like you said, Eric, why, you know, you may have had issues with it because it is a very art house type film. And it was one of the reasons why they determined to release it as a VOD rather than the theatrical release that they thought they were going to release it as. So that's Under the Silver Lake by the director of It Follows. So me, Eric, and Chrissy are done. What about you, Mike? Anything you wanted to bring up?
I did see several films being on break and whatnot. I'm trying to think. So I caught another horror film that's a foreign film from 2019 called Luz. I think that's on Shudder right now.
Yeah. That's supposed to be pretty good here.
Any good?
I wasn't a fan. It was interesting. It's short. It's like 70 minutes, so it's certainly and again, if you're on Shudder, it doesn't cost anything anymore. So it's not necessarily a horrible thing to check out. It's one of these things where I think the telling of the story was more interesting than the story itself, in just the way that they tell it. Low budget, creatively shot. I just kind of lost patience with it kind of by the end. I know it's ended up on a lot of people's best of lists, and a lot of people seem to really like it, so don't necessarily take my word for it. I just was kind of meh about it. Another one also off Netflix was called Boar, about a killer boar that I saw in some people had on their top list for the year. I don't know why.
I watched that.
I don't know. I just figured it was going to be cheesy. So
it is cheesy,
I didn't think it was that bad. I thought it was okay, but nothing to put on my list, though.
No, it was stunningly mediocre in every way that's imaginable. It was, you know, which is the thing. Like, cheese is great. Cheese can be fantastic. And God, like, I love Piranha 3D. That's a cheesy as hell film. But it's just, like, the acting isn't bad. Not good, but it's not bad. The writing's not good, but it's not... Other than a few lines of dialogue, it's not really that bad. It's about as generic a killer animal film as you can get. The killer boar is mostly done with a puppet, and it's not bad. You know, it's just, you know, people are killed in it, and the kills aren't bad, but they're not necessarily memorable either. It's just and I think I've said this, that that sort of mediocrity is its own kind of suck in a way. You know, it just sort of, why am I watching that? There was nothing for me to grab onto in the film, which is weird because I like those kind of nature attacks films. But it wasn't even bad, like a bad sci-fi film where it's just, oh my God, this is just really awful, let me turn it off. It's just kind of like, maybe it'll get better. Maybe it'll, because it's hovering along, but it never, so I don't know how it ended up on anyone's top 20 list. Is I guess my point. Let's see. And I think the other one. Oh, and I saw Freaks, which again I highly recommend. Which is again more science fiction. The Headhunter. I think Eric, you've mentioned this. This came up as a possibility for an episode a few weeks ago, and it's been on my watch list. It's on Shudder. Another one's only about 70 minutes. This is a really neat idea for about a 45-minute episode of,
right.
Like, of what was that? Tales from the Crypt or Creepshow.
What movie is this?
Headhunter.
Oh.
It's a neat concept, and if somebody loves this film, I wouldn't necessarily find fault with it. I just found that they didn't quite have enough, even for the 70-minute runtime. It's a one-person film. It's about a hunter. Was a monster hunter in some medieval D&D setting, whose daughter is killed by a monster, and we just see like a montage of every day he gets up in his little house when there's a smoke signal or a siren or something goes off, summons him, means there's a monster threatening the land. He gears up in your Sam Raimi gearing up montage. Leaves, comes back to the cabin. When he comes back in the cabin, he has a head in a bag that he throws on a spike on the wall, and so his whole
that's the whole fucking movie.
And that's kind of, and then one day the monster that killed his daughter shows up and he goes out to go to hunt that, and then stuff happened from there. He also has a magic healing potion, you know, because he comes back with some wounds that he rubs on himself to heal from whatever stuff it is. So it's a little bit of definitely a fantasy element to it, and it's a neat idea. I have a feeling it's a very low budget film, so they did with it what they could. But the director I don't think is strong enough to take this very thin premise and stretch it out over the running time. If you had taken the same thing and compacted down to 45 minutes, I think it could have been really good. Very, very memorable idea and a neat concept. Just not enough for the runtime. But I'd still, again, Shudder, 70 minutes. I would act, you know, depending on what you like, you could go with Luz, you could go with Headhunter. And the only other film I saw was not horror, but crime thriller, I guess, sort of, which is Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler.
I heard good things about that.
It is fantastic. And I mean, unfortunately, it does mean another round of who'd have thought a funny actor could do drama? You know, which we get that every.
Well,
like,
he's kind of already has, right?
He did it, so people shouldn't be surprised. But
yeah, no, it's show me the dramatic actor who can do good comedy, then that's when I get surprised.
Right.
Again, the old line: dying is easy, comedy is hard. Okay. Yeah. So I highly recommend it. It's a very convoluted story, and it entwines real life events. It's set in 2012 against the NBA. Finals. And so I found it really hard to believe because there's so many implausible things that happen in the film where it's so complex that I really thought it might have been based on a true story, but it's not. It is based on little things that happened that the writers knew of, I guess, because their dad worked in the Diamond District and so they knew stories. But the whole thing isn't original work, but they are incorporating real people like Kevin Garnett. The NBA player is a big part of the story, and they do it really, really well. And it's just really neat. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes, but it's very, very fast paced, constantly on the go.
Did you see that in the theater, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay.
I highly recommend catching it. I'm sure it'll be around for a bit because it's got good word of mouth. It's going to be up for all bunches of awards, so it's going to be in theaters for at least a couple more weeks, I would think.
I've heard more than one person say that movie filled them with anxiety for pretty much the entire runtime.
Yeah, well, because the
character... Like A Quiet Place.
No, it's different. See, the character is that Adam Sandler plays is, you know, runs a jewelry store in the Diamond District, but he's always got a side hustle. He's always... it's never good enough. He's never got money because he's in debt to some people. He's trying to get out of it, and he's also a gambler. So every time he gets money, rather than keep the money, he immediately tries to parlay it into more money. So he's always doing something. He's always scheming. He's always plotting, and you never quite know what he's doing. You just know he's going to fuck up somehow because that's what he is, right? He's a screw up in a lot of ways. But he's kind of chasing that high, you know, of the win. And so he's always on that edge of everything just falling apart completely. And you're just waiting for it to happen through the entire film. And I think that's where that anxiety comes from.
Right. Episode worthy?
Maybe. I don't know. Not sure if it's a Dark Discussions episode. That it might be more of a... what do you call
Cinema
that?
A la carte.
Cinema a la carte episode. You know, you guys watch it and tell me what you think.
Okay.
All right, very well. So it seems like it's probably similar, Eric, into the Three Billboards type of category rather than true horror. I mean, thriller. I don't know. That's interesting. Sounds good.
I've heard nothing but good things about that movie, so I will check it out at some point.
Yeah. I was thinking of checking it out too, but I don't know if I'll be able to catch it at the theaters. But it may last a while if it gets some nominations. So, anything else, Mike?
No, that's it.
All right, very well. Anything else anybody want to bring up? Anything? All right, I guess not.
Yeah, no, I did. I did see a movie called, I think it's called "Can You Ever Forgive Me?" It is. Not genre, it's not horror, but I do know a lot of listeners to this podcast are writers and or artists or filmmakers or artistic in some way.
Oh, is that the one with Melissa McCarthy?
Stars as Lee Israel.
Okay.
Yes, and it is excellent. It's really good. However, I will tell you, it is an exercise in depression. Because it's very depressing. you know, watching her struggle and figure this out. But it's fascinating. For those of you who don't know the story, Lee Israel was a writer. She wrote a lot of biographies, and she eventually became desperate, like many other writers do, and there was not enough money for her to survive. And through a series of circumstances, she figures out something that I'm not going to spoil it, but she figures something out that's pretty illegal. And it's basically how she pretty much gets away with it up until a certain point, and then things unravel again. But it is an excellent movie. It's very well written and very well done. What were you going to say, Eric?
I was going to say that movie also spurred a round of, oh my God, this funny person can act.
Yeah, that's what made me think of it when you were talking about Adam Sandler. Because I was like, oh my God, well, yeah, you should have seen Melissa McCarthy in this movie.
Oh, yeah. That's about that scumbag, Lee Israel. Yeah, now I know who you're talking about. I remember about this film. Yeah.
Well, sure. It was kind of funny because this movie, they really paint her, I think, as, you know, kind of the brusque, inappropriate, socially rude person, you know, that I suppose she was. I did not know her, so I cannot attest to that. However, what makes this story interesting, and it is a true story. Like, this is pretty much a, you know, creative nonfiction telling of her story, how this really happened. This is really true. However, she, like many of us, they really show her as a human. She honestly gets herself into no more or less terrible situations than we all do. And that's where the universal hits. You know, she stops being a writer who did this terrible thing. She's a person trying to survive. And I think that's what this movie did really well. You know, you're able to identify with her. And at one point, you're rooting for her to, like, you know, oh my God, don't catch her. Like, seriously, because they make her, you feel bad because you're like, oh my God, I've been here. Like, I've been in a situation where I had to buy dog food to eat. Like, I've been there. Maybe not that bad, but you know what I mean?
Well,
I've been in a situation where I had no money.
We got to be careful with these biopics about bad people, too. So, you know, because sometimes they're done by people who have certain feelings for those quote unquote bad people, you know, rather than just because, oh, this is a cool story because of this crazy person and what they did.
Well, just remember it's a work of fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, oh, you know, yeah, I completely forgot. I saw Ford versus Ferrari, which is a good movie, but I don't want to spend time with that our kind of film. But anytime, go look up online something like Hollywood Fact versus Fiction and websites like that, and go fact check these quote unquote true stories, and you'll find usually the most incredible moments never happened.
Sure.
Yeah, and anything that says it's based on a true story is bullshit. It's inspired by a true story.
Yep.
And anything that says it's a documentary is telling the truth that it wants to tell.
Yes. I agree 100%.
In this case, the Can You Ever Forgive Me story was based on Lee Israel's book that she wrote about her own experience. So if you really want what actually happened after you see this movie and you're intrigued, go buy her book. It is her book. She wrote it. It's from her point of view, and that will give you exactly what happened. But
it's from her point of view, which is called an autobiography,
and there's a certain amount of subjectivity that you're expected to have with that.
Right, but you always have to remember that
if you were a bad person, you're obviously going to try to make it not as bad as it really was, too. You know, you're not going to write about yourself and say, "Yeah, I was a scumbag." You know, so.
Some people do.
Well, you might.
You never know. So, all right. Very well. All right. So, I think that's pretty much it. Once again, this was the what is this episode called, Mike? What do we call this?
Well, it was the bucket list, New Year's bucket list episode, New Year's resolution, something like that.
Yep. And this is, like you said, third or fourth year we've done it.
We don't know what we call it, but we'll probably do it again next year.
Yeah, what we call it, the New Year resolution bucket list, is what generally it's turned out to be called, I think.
But it doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. No.
I think the bucket list episode is cool, though, because it's pretty, I mean, it says what it is.
Yeah, it's fun.
I mean, everybody
it's
goes,
fun.
Yeah,
I just
fun.
I think the whole reasoning behind doing it is funny. That's all.
Right. All right. So I guess that pretty much we can wrap it up. We'll be doing it, coming out with our 2019 wrap up episode soon, and we're coming out with our 2020 what we are looking forward to episode. But really? In between there, we're going to be doing a.
I thought you said we could cancel the looking forward if we did this movie next week.
No, we're just pushing.
That's what I said. I said I'll watch that movie if we do it instead of the looking forward episode.
No, we got to do
it. All right, then I'll skip next week.
No, next week we're doing the movie.
Yeah, but
Eric.
The week after is when we're going to do.
And you skipped the looking forward to before, Eric.
Yeah,
you did.
Yeah, if you don't want to do it, don't.
Yeah, you don't have to.
I just think that whole thing's silly.
Personally, I'd rather do the 2020 looking forward than the 2019 looking back.
What I live for. That's why I even do this podcast.
So Eric, we should swap. You do the 2019 since you've seen a ton of movies and I've seen nothing, and I'll do the 2020 moving forward.
I don't
it's
even
a win,
like to
man.
Know what's coming up. I just like to look at what's coming out in the theater this week and choose something.
It's a win. We can totally swap. All right.
So either way, what's on the agenda is we're doing a new film next week, then we're doing the 2020 looking forward to, whether Eric joins us or not, we'll see. And then we'll do the 2019 review at the end of January. So give us a little more time to put all our lists together and whatnot. So I guess with all that stated, Eric, why don't you listen up?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us do our New Year's resolution bucket list thingy. Come back next week. We'll be talking about a new movie.